Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
Ladies and gentlemen, please remain standing for the singing of our national anthem.
He said Britain is just a small island that no one pays attention to.
A former colony won the right to determine its own destiny.
Hello and welcome to Mid-Atlantic, the show where we look at the news and the views from one side of the Atlantic from the perspective of the other. I'm Royfield Brown, who's about to fly off to Toronto to see my son graduate from high school tomorrow. Today we are joined by the journalist of 1,000 Quips, Mick Wright, in Norwich, and by the woman that Time magazine described as an outspoken voice of the left. It's Amanda Marcotte in Brooklyn in New York. Say hello, folks.
Hello, hello. Folks.
That gag. He's just going to follow.
I'm sticking with you, mate.
Aren't you?
I've done it every episode.
Yeah, 4 years and it's still going strong. In a week that has seen a Californian woman threaten to call the police on an 8-year-old black girl for selling water, we ask, is it right to refuse to serve a politician in public?
White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders was asked to leave a Virginia restaurant Friday. The co-owner of the Red Hen in Lexington, Virginia, Stephanie Wilkinson, told the Washington Post her decision to ask Sanders to leave was based on the concerns of several employees. Wilkinson expressed no regret and said she felt justified in her action because Sanders is a public official, not a regular customer. Sanders confirmed the incident in a tweet on Saturday, writing she was asked to leave because of her association with President Trump. She also wrote, her actions say far more about her than about me. I always do my best to treat people, including those I disagree with, respectfully, and will continue to do so. Sanders is just the latest administration official to be received poorly in a public setting.
And family separation! If kids don't eat in peace, you don't eat in peace!
Protesters confronted Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen at a Mexican restaurant in Washington last week over the Trump administration's family separation policy. And advisor Stephen Miller faced his own protester just days before when another customer called him a fascist.
The White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders was kicked out of the Red Hen restaurant in Lexington, Virginia on Friday night because she works for President Donald Trump. Was the owner right to ask her to leave? Amanda in hipster Brooklyn, New York, over to you.
I think there's a lot of people conflating a lot of different issues on this question. I think it hit particularly hard because it happened after the Supreme Court sort of punted on the Masterpiece Cake Shop issue here in the U.S., where there was a debate over whether or not a baker had a right to turn away a same-sex couple who came in trying to buy a wedding cake. And I think, you know, there were accusations of hypocrisy kind of flying from both sides of the aisle, like liberals accusing conservatives of being hypocrites for being outraged about Sarah Huckabee Sanders while defending this baker for turning away a same-sex couple. And conservatives accusing liberals of being hypocrites because they defended the same-sex couple while also saying you can turn away Sarah Huckabee Sanders. And listeners should go to Salon. It should be up by the time this episode goes up, but I am writing a piece right now kind of, you know, pulling out these different cases and explaining why they're different. But at the end of the day, you know, there's a huge difference between these laws in America that prevent discrimination on the basis of race and gender and sexual orientation, and ejecting somebody from a business because they don't meet, they personally as a person are not meeting, you know, the standards of the atmosphere or whatever you're trying to create in your business. And, you know, Huckabee Sanders was not discriminated against because of her race or gender or even arguably her political affiliation. She was discriminated against because she is a spokesman for human rights abuses.
But Amanda, one of the kind of cornerstones of the Civil Rights Act in the mid-1960s was you couldn't discriminate against people because of the color of their skin, mm-hmm. right? You absolutely couldn't. And kind of, though it was never codified into law, that politically you can't do that. Is the surely that a line actually has been crossed here? And I must admit, I'm incredibly conflicted about this. I go backwards and forwards on this, and I think I've just about got my position, which I'll kind of reveal later. But it does appear to me that to ask somebody to leave who is a paid official of the United States government, and there might be enacting some policies which you find egregious, is actually ethically wrong, if not actually wrong.
I disagree. I mean, you know, first of all, I would challenge the notion that because the United States has various anti-discrimination laws and a patchwork system across states, that has created this sort of come one, come all, you know, moral and ethical stance. You know, for instance, if you go out clubbing in any big city in this country on Friday or Saturday night, you will see people turned away from nightclubs for how they're dressed, for what they look like. Much less serious, quote unquote, offenses than being a spokesperson for baby jails, which was, you know, really the line that Sarah Huckabee Sanders crossed that caused this business owner to kick her out, you know? So I think it's more complicated than that.
Do you know, I think Karl Popper kind of gave us a very clear answer on this in 1945. So he published a book called The Open Society and Its Enemies, and in that he put forward this thing which he called the paradox of tolerance. And basically, the notion is this, that the need, in order to have a tolerant society, you sometimes need to be intolerant of the
intolerant.
not tolerate mm. the intolerant. Because mm. what, you know, you look at President Heidelberg in Germany and tolerating the Nazis. The Nazis were tolerated and tolerated and tolerated until they took sufficient power that they eradicated tolerance. So in a sense, I'm kind of a bit, and I'm very tired of the civility police who are out enforcing it in the US at the moment, because their attitudes are, you know, Trump supporters, Trump officials have shown very little tolerance for other people. So they've sort of abrogated their right to it. The other thing I would say is, if you look at, you know, American notions of free speech, in a sense, what that restaurant owner is doing is not discriminating against her, but rather exercising a kind of free speech, in the sense that private space, you know, and creating a private space, like if you're a restaurateur, you're creating an environment. It's sort of a kind of speech act. And in that sense, you're saying, in order for the freedoms of everybody else in this restaurant, including my workers, some of whom are, you know, immigrant workers, and that's a key point here, to be comfortable, this person who is acting against the interests of immigrants and migrants in all kinds of ways shouldn't be here. So, yeah, it's kind of complicated, but it's kind of simple. Like, particularly as the fact that we see Sarah Huckabee Sanders project all kinds of intolerances in the White House briefing room on a nearly daily basis, well, when she decides to do an on-camera briefing, that is.
Yeah, and I would agree with you, Mick, in the too, that I think a lot of people are overlooking, you know, the critical question of power here. You know, the reason that we have anti-discrimination laws that in this country is specifically because historically the people that the classes of people that are called protected classes, the sort of categories of discrimination we don't allow are ones that people have traditionally been discriminated against in ways that materially affect them. So, you know, the fact that, you know, people of color were segregated in American society, you know, wasn't just sort of abstractly wrong. It was also, you know, caused material daily damage to their quality of life. Sarah Huckabee Sanders not getting a cheese plate isn't going to change the fact that tomorrow she gets to be still one of the most powerful people in the country. And failing to understand that context, you know, and trying to reduce everything to these kind of hypotheticals or these civility questions is missing the point.
No, and I think that is right. And her father then tweeting out that this was discrimination, you know, is bonkers. He's bonkers. No, Amanda, I think you're absolutely right. But what this has done is to go and ramp up America's kind of culture war, isn't it? Where people who historically have not been victims, of which you kind of touched on, can now say we are victims as much as anybody else. And actually, our victimhood trumps yours, pun absolutely not intended. So what is this now saying about civil discourse in the United States if what, in a week, is it 1, 2, 3 American, prominent American politicians can be hounded out of public spaces, though? What does this say about civil discourse, Mick?
Again, I think to an extent it just shows the left maybe fighting back in against some of the things the right have done, and showing them that there are consequences to these policies. There are consequences for acting in this way, and the notion that the civil discourse is worse now than it was in the past is sort of crazy, because if you look at the civil rights, because what's happening a lot is particularly on Fox and other right-wing talk show environments, they're sort of implying that civil discourse was much more polite in the past, and you've got old white guys talking about the civil rights movement. But, you know, Martin Luther King was shot, Malcolm X was shot, Robert Kennedy was assassinated. Civil discourse in America has not been particularly polite ever, really.
Mick, let's not go back 50 years, 60 years.
No, why not, though? Because they're bringing it back to that. What's more, they're bringing it back to hold on for just one second, because they are bringing it back. And the thing that's really getting me around these discussions is you see the sort of people who would have argued for water cannons against the civil rights marches bringing up the name of Martin Luther King to support the notion of some sort of like old timey civility. But that's like, you have sometimes to protest against huge injustices, you cannot be civil to do it. It's like people who always kind of reach towards Mandela in his later years, you know, the old soft voice Mandela, and forget the Mandela of the 60s who was an armed revolutionary. Like, sometimes you can, civility will not get the job done.
Well, and I it's not even, we don't need to reach back even or even look at the left. I mean, the hypocrisy and disingenuous nature of this is proved by who these folks are defending, which is Donald Trump, right? He's somebody who brags about sexual assault. He's somebody who made fun of a reporter's disability on the campaign trail. He is somebody who calls names, who is uncivil in every possible way. I mean, I hesitate to even sit here and like list it out. And I think what is kind of interesting about this discussion is, first of all, it's obvious bad faith. You can't support Donald Trump and then claim you're for civility, flat out. That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life. Second of all, it kind of really highlights, I think, what is the issue here, which is you can't avoid these culture wars. There's this sense that a lot of us get into that if the left can somehow manipulate the right by being nice or doing this or doing that into them not culture warring at us anymore. And that's not going to happen. Like, the reason Sarah Huckabee Sanders is a crazy racist who defends baby jail is not because somebody was mean to her in a restaurant. The meanness in the restaurant was after the defending of baby jails. Like, the culture war is happening whether we like it or not. Now the only question is whether we're willing to fight.
Do you think, Mick, that this is another one of these kind of examples of CEO activism? You know, we've had Larry Fink's letter to shareholders calling for the company leaders to abandon the neutral ground when the social contract is at stake. We had Starbucks closing down for a day to give racial bias training after two black customers were arrested for not making a purchase while they waited for their friends. So there is this kind of recent tradition of this. And then also, I kind of think that this notion of business leaders, however big, however small, calling out political leaders or the mores of the time is incredibly, incredibly powerful. What do you think?
I don't think it fits in the category of that other stuff. Because how did we find out that this happened? We found out that this happened because Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the massive bully that she is, misused a government means of communication, the official press secretary Twitter account, to tell us that this happened and to note how polite and nice she is versus this horrible restaurant owner who did this. Now, as I understand it, I think that she's in violation of some sort of US law around this as well.
Email instead of a private email. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's something like a Hatch Act or something. But yeah, it's the point with her is that the point with this is, what was the actual owner of the restaurant doing? As far as I can tell, the owner was not trying to make a public political statement, but more to act in the interests of the employees who felt uncomfortable about serving this person who is acting in a way that is, you know, contrary to, they believe, to their rights. So actually, it's just about an employer acting in the interests of their employees. It became a political statement when Sarah Huckabee Sanders decided to use it as a means to, you know, highlight how the left bullies the right, in her view.
Mm. Amanda, do you think that the food at that restaurant is going to be morally superior and must then taste more delicious now?
I mean, possibly. I think, you know, to what Mick was saying, I think we do have to consider the possibility that many of these particular situations are being orchestrated by Trump administration officials and professional trolls like Milo Yiannopoulos on the right. You know, why this restaurant? Why did Kristen Nielsen go to a Mexican restaurant? You know, why? I feel like I'm getting into somewhat conspiracy theory territory, but I do kind of think that there is they do think this runs to their political benefit. And I think that, you know, we know for a fact that Mike Pence has done this on purpose in order to create a public spectacle. He's gone to NFL games. He went to Hamilton specifically with hopes that he would provoke a reaction by the people there, you know, going into the liberal territory to provoke a reaction so he could play the victim. So, I mean, I think we should have a healthy amount of skepticism to begin with, that the reason that Sarah Huckabee Sanders went to a farm-to-table restaurant in a town that voted solidly for Hillary Clinton that was 2 hours out of her way might not have been for the purest of motivations, as it were.
But still, right, and I asked this question before and it wasn't sufficiently answered to my liking. And whoever wants to jump in with this, feel free to jump in. At least initially, in the initial fallout, there has been, as much as us lefties are going, woo, 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 you go, owner. And yes, I completely understand and I take your point, Mick, that if she's got Latino kitchen staff, wait staff, and I believe there's some gay staff there also, that these people, they're just kind of like beside themselves with shock that this woman would actually turn up and they'd feel incredibly uncomfortable. So I get that, and that she was defending her staff and actually taking their fears and their feelings into consideration. But we have to, I would say that us on the left at the moment have the moral high ground, that we've entered into discourse not in bad faith and not trying to demonize the other in the way that Trump and his acolytes actually have. What we haven't done on the left is we haven't demonized. And there's a world away from refusing service to somebody and politely explaining why. There's a world of difference between that and shouting at somebody in a restaurant and almost like a baying mob, of which then they're forced to flee. And I don't want us to do that. I think the owner of the Red Hen restaurant, completely and utterly within her rights, to sit down with Sarah Huckabee Sanders and say, the effect of your policies and the administration that is promoting them is creating harm to real people. And some of those real people are in this establishment right now. They have brothers, cousins, aunts, whatever, which your policies are affecting. And the language that your boss, the president, is using is then ratcheting up a sense of fear. So with that in mind, I think we should comp your meal and really you should go. I don't have a problem with that. But with the Kristen Nielsen thing, I am very uneasy, extremely uneasy. And I think that is incredibly pernicious. And we can't slide into that where people who we disagree with, we shout and bay at them in a public space.
I really disagree. I think it's impossible for the left to lose the moral high ground so long as we are not the ones putting children in jail.
Well, that was actually going to be my next point. My next question. Let me just finish this point and then the floor is over to the pair.
It's like an essay, this one.
No, stop it. Stop it, you. Is it, has this happened this week because of the baby jails? Or was this going to happen anyway because of the ratcheting up of the language from the Trump regime for the last 18 months?
I think it was the baby jails. I think it really was. I mean, and the thing is, sure, it might have been some other tipping point, but whatever other tipping point it was going to be equally evil. And I think that's part of the reason that I find this discourse about the discourse to be troubling, because it is a distraction from the fact that the reason people are committing, these acts of public spectacle, the reason people are doing things that are quote unquote rude, that are committing civil disobedience, all sorts of things, is because we are facing down a very real threat in this country that Donald Trump is going to, destroy our democracy, dismantle human rights. This is not, we are in a national emergency, and I'm a little worried that people are forgetting that. And I'm not particularly interested in policing how the left draws attention to that fact. It could be that, the mainstream media finger wagging turns into the situation where the public spectacle tactics sort of backfire by making the discourse about civility. But, you know, to what Mick was saying, and I think he's right about the historical, you know, precedence, is the same thing did happen to Martin Luther King. The same thing happened to civil rights protesters. They were also finger wagged at, told to wait their turn, said they were being disruptive and that this was not the way to go. And that turned out to be completely incorrect. It turned out that the needle was never going to move unless people were willing to color outside the lines.
I think you've also got to take into account that you're dealing with a political, you're dealing with an administration who don't so much want to shift the Overton window as smash it up entirely. And when you look at stuff like the baby jails, and which is, like, I think is the best way to talk about it, because that's literally what it is. You shouldn't allow them to wrap it up into bureaucratic language. When you deal with stuff like that, what you're looking at is they do stuff where people are so shocked that they've separated families, you know, from the children, that then people are almost cheering them on or applauding them for saying, oh, we'll get the families back together. So what you're actually saying is, yeah, we'll get the families back together in just the same kind of camps. You know, we'll cage them. We'll just put them in bigger cages. You know, that's why it is necessary to shout, and it's why it's necessary to not be civil. It's this, we've had this issue in the United Kingdom for a long time, where politeness is used as the tool of elites in order to stop people from saying uncomfortable things that raise questions that might make people say, this cannot stand. But if you can put politeness and etiquette around it, you can get away with a hell of a lot of dark shit.
Mm. So just ending up on this, Amanda, this is your country, which is going through this this moral kind of crisis at the moment. Are you telling me that, because listen to your answer before, you said that you are worried about the shift of America into some kind of form of dictatorship. Are you seriously telling me that the institutions of the United States, which are over some 200 years old, which have seen off the antics of Tyrone Burr at the founding of the Republic, it's seen off a civil war and has had the seismic shocks of civil rights in the 1960s, et cetera, that the institutions of the United States are going to wobble and could well fall because of Donald Trump? Surely not.
I really wish I wasn't saying that, but unfortunately, you know, a lot of the times the Republic was saved in the past, I think it was a lot closer call than people would like to really admit. And I think that Donald Trump could very well do it, especially if he is not resisted to the utmost. And, you know, as we are speaking about this, as we're recording this, the Supreme Court, which has been stacked not just by Trump, but by other Republicans who were similarly hostile to democracy, just issued a flatly unconstitutional ruling, upholding Donald Trump's Muslim travel ban. A travel ban that is in direct violation of the First Amendment, of the Constitution of the United States, that holds that we should not discriminate, that the government has no right to interfere with people's religious beliefs. And the fact of the matter is they just upheld a ban on people because of their religious beliefs. And there's, you know, they came up with all sorts of goofy excuses for why that wasn't true, but at the end of the day, I would argue that the constitutional crisis is already here. We already have a president that's been calling for the end of due process. We already have a court that just violated and smashed through the First Amendment in the most egregious way. We already have a president that has been asserting, and I fear with this Supreme Court, will get away with smashing the longstanding precedent that our leader, our executive, is still a citizen and is held accountable to the law as citizens should be held. You know, whenever the Mueller investigation is finished. These things are coming, and you know, whether those are real threats to the Republic. I obviously cannot predict. I don't see the future. But I can safely say those are very real threats, and we should take them very seriously. And failure to do so makes it a lot easier for Trump to succeed in ending American democracy as we know it.
Yeah, I know I keep looking at historical parallels, Royfield, and it's getting on your tits, but I'm going to do it anyway. But I know that we often, like, it's almost, you know, everyone says, oh, well, we always go back to Weimar slipping into Nazi Germany as a sort of example of what happens in history. But if you look at the way that the Weimar Republic collapsed and the Nazi totalitarian state grew up, it was a slow slide for a long time. But then after the Reichstag fire, it was a matter of 8 weeks before the first concentration camp was opened. So we've got many historical, and it's the same thing in Soviet Russia. We've got many historical parallels of quick moves from countries that had democratic constitutions or constitutional arrangements and settlements that seem to be, you know, a permanent thing, that have fallen apart. The notion to me that bothers me sometimes is this sort of American exceptionalism idea that the American Constitution is so robust that it can survive anything. And it's not.
No.
It's just not. Yeah. Any constitution can be worn away and destroyed. And that's what bothers me about this stuff, because people say, oh, well, don't be so hyperbolic. But in the end, sometimes it's necessary when you look at a threat and you say, these people are truly anti-democratic. And it's not just Trump himself. It's that I feel that there are darker figures around Trump who are able to push Trump in the direction they want him to go in.
Hmm. No, normally, yeah, well done, sir. Normally, when we pose a topic, it's only right and proper to let the person of the country, which the topic's really aimed at, to have the final word. So, on this somewhat dispiriting and I would say apocalyptic note, Amanda Marquardt, it's over to you for your final thoughts and feelings, because I feel somewhat outmaneuvered by the pair of you on this. Somewhat I'm playing devil's advocate by trying to say that we should moderate our speech. And I think neither of you have still really answered my one point. It's only one point I've made in all of this, because obviously I agree with the pair of you emotionally, ethically, every which way. But is that the initial fruits of this is for those people, however wrong-headed they are, to support or not to believe that this policy is a disgusting slur on the face of American politics, what this Trump regime was actually doing, and the fact that they're so callously doing it. And when they were called out on it, when it became public knowledge for the first week or so, that people like Jeff Sessions and that weasel, Stephen Miller, were basically laughing and just saying, but it's kind of not so bad. And, you know, and if you come with the border with your kids, we tell you we're going to take your kids away, type of thing. Right. But still, because of how the argument has been won morally, ethically, in the court of public opinion. But by shouting and screaming, however heartfelt and true that emotion is, and hounding out that woman who is somebody of high privilege, I take that point, Amanda, out of a restaurant, it ratchets up just another notch or two the public intolerance and discourse, and people on the far, I'm not going to say the far right, I don't want to say the far right, because then we can kind of emotionally dismiss them. But some people, Mike Huckabee, for example, right? He was somebody who I used to think 10 plus years ago was okay. He's a bit of a religious nut, but he wasn't the worst in terms of that type of Republican, but seems to have drifted right and right and more right. That people like that, who 10 years ago were in the mainstream of American political politics and just say, haha, there you go, right? The fundamental glue which binds any society together has to be at the heart that most people, most of the time, can talk and have a discourse with each other, and that is gone. And people like Mike Huckabee can then talk about discrimination. And that's what I worry about, is that people who don't fundamentally think that this policy is wrong and that this presidency is wrong can just say, look at the intolerance that we're showing. Yes, we absolutely know that at the heart of this administration is intolerance, but then they can throw it back at us. And that is my worry in all of this.
I think ultimately we can tie ourselves into all sorts of knots, but we need to stop discussing these culture war issues as one-sided, where only the left has autonomy, only the left has power. And I think that the problem, of course, is that's how we do talk about it. You know, Mike Huckabee says racist stuff. He's never actually been a good guy. He just played one on TV. He's always been a terrible human being. You know, his son, killed some dog in some horrible way and got away with it. Like, that family is rotten to the core. But I would say, you know, getting away from him, I would say that the failure, I think, on a lot of our pieces, and I understand that a lot of us feel helpless and we want to feel like we can somehow raise the level of discourse single-handedly. But unfortunately, we can't do that while the other side is like baby jails, Donald Trump is our president, pussy grabbing, blah, blah, right? Like, it's over. It's done. Now, they have declared war on us. And the question now really remains, do we fight back? But I think that it's a little bit naive to think that if the left stops screaming at people in restaurants or protesting at their house or somehow found a way to.
I didn't say anything about that.
Fair. But, you know, whatever the civility debate is this week, and there will always be something, you know. Whatever we ratchet it back to, they will declare still too rude and fuss about that, because this is not a good faith argument. You know, what it is the right trying to assert that they can say and do what they want and the left can't respond in kind or even at all. It is the bully's argument, is the abuser's argument. It's the why are you making me hit you argument. And I think we have to get past that. We have to say, no, you hit me because you want to. And that's the only way we can kind of move forward. We have to stop getting derailed with this nonsense.
Right. I tell you one nonsense we're not going to get derailed by. It's the next 3 weeks of the World Cup.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Who's in Nizhny Novgorod for us? Just for those who don't know, there aren't many, fill us in on the score.
It's an amazing win for England. 6-1 against Panama. 5 goals in the first half, 2 from John Stones, 2 from Harry Kane. At least Panama managed to get 1 goal, their first goal in a World Cup, their first appearance in a World Cup ever. I do have some England fans for you right here, Neil and Richard. How are you feeling after that amazing triumph?
I'm in shock, really. I don't think it's ever happened that we've been 5-0 up at half-time in a World Cup. We were both looking at each other in disbelief, thinking, what a great game to choose to come to Russia and see.
What was the atmosphere like in the stadium? Because there aren't that many of you.
No, absolutely amazing atmosphere. I mean, either end, we could see, you know, we saw the England Supporters Club at one end. We saw England supporters at the other. I mean, it was we were sitting in the middle, wonderful atmosphere. We were alongside Panama fans. That fire staff, we've never seen anything like that. Kane, I mean, we were ultra clinical. Every chance we had, we took. Absolutely amazing.
We beat Panama 6-1. After what, 52 years of hurt, is it time to start to dare to dream of lifting up the World Cup this year?
This is incredible, isn't it? This happens every time with England in tournaments, is that we, before the tournament, we talk about how we need to keep our expectations within reasonable bounds because, you know, we've got a bad history tournament football.
Mick, I know you always think that interrupts you. And then
you do, because you do. Because you do.
I absolutely disagree with the first line of what you said. We don't always do that. It's been a relatively recent occurrence.
We screw up in tournament football.
That our attitude going in, the public and the media's attitude going in. For the last two tournaments, we've thought we're not going to do anything.
Anyway, get back to my point, you rude man. My point with this is, look, the reason I suggested this topic, and it's because I want to talk about a wider issue, which is English arrogance and like the weird distorted nature of English identity, in that we kind of think we're the worst, but also think we're the best at everything. So we're really ready to jump on the heads of people like the England football team when they don't hit our expectations. But we also are willing to just completely ignore past performance. Our tournament performance in the past, you know, 40 odd years, 50 odd years. So it's really interesting to me because we beat Panama, right? And it was like, we're a world-class football team playing like a Sunday league pub team. And we kind of went, isn't it amazing? We beat them 6-1. We didn't beat Spain 6-1 or Colombia or Brazil. We beat Panama, who've never been in a World Cup before, and we conceded a goal against them. So it's like, this is a great metaphor for Brexit Britain, where we just think we can punch way above our weight. It's ridiculous.
Amanda.
you're expressing everything that went through my head while that game was on, but I did not say out loud.
But okay, right? You can only beat the opposition that's in front of you. Granted, and Panama didn't come to that World Cup thinking that they were going to win it.
Well, they thought they were in a WWE wrestling match.
Well, they did. There were a bunch of wrestlers. There were hatchet men. That, you know, they were playing rugby. They were playing rugby. They were not playing football, right? And the attitude of the Panamanian manager at the end of that game, right, he was just laughing. And he just smiled when he shook Southgate's hand, the England manager, and shook him by the hand very warmly. They'd come just to take part in a festival of football, right? And they were going to try their best to keep the score down. But, right, how many times, with the exception of Brazil in the last World Cup, which was, 7-1 against Germany against Brazil in the last World Cup, how many times have teams actually run up cricket scores against other teams? It's actually not that much of a common occurrence. You know, so, you know, let's give England a certain amount of credit here, Mick.
Well, we did the notorious 5-1 against Germany in a friendly, didn't we?
But that wasn't in the World Cup, though. It wasn't in the World Cup.
Well, I know there is some credit.
And it wasn't friendly.
There is some credit. And look, I will admit to, in my heart, having the same thing where I keep thinking to myself, well, maybe because they seem to be a more together side, etc., etc. But you know, we're coming out of... I'll be interested to see how we do against Belgium, a team with actually quality players.
Yeah, but they're just an all-star team, aren't they, Amanda? Belgium, right, it's just a team of overpaid, pumped-up egomaniacs, right, with Mino as a manager. Right, come on, Amanda, back me up here. Because, like, isn't America starting to love soccer?
They say that every World Cup, that this is the one that...
And it becomes more true for
two reasons. I think one is that the sport is becoming more popular around the world, period, right? And we're just part of a worldwide trend. And two, because I think it really kind of goes back to what is the debate, it seems, in the United States about every issue is immigration, I think, has really had this tremendous impact on who likes soccer in the United States, where soccer is popular and where it's kind of gone viral, as it were. You know, you see here in New York City, World Cup is like crazy. Like every bar's got viewings, everyone's talking about it. And that's not a surprise. This is an immigrant city. And you see it like in the Western United States, where there's a huge influx of people from Mexico and Latin America generally. I just don't know about the rest of the country, though. I think they still don't care.
Do you think, Amanda, that but America is starting to care more, and it's starting to care more since the 1994 World Cup. I was struck, and yes, the Bay Area is one of the liberal bastions of the United States, and yes, as you said, it's a place where there are a lot of Latino first, second, third generation Americans, so at least they still have some kind of allegiance to some kind of roots to other countries. And then there are other immigrants, people like myself and everybody else on planet Earth, with the exception maybe of the country of India, comes from a country where football is, if it's not number one sport, it's number two sport. And I'm really struck when I'm in the Bay Area that I can go to any bar and actually have a conversation with a random American. And they know when I say football, yes, they smile, but then they talk about football, not American crazy rugby football with metal helmets. They'll go, yeah, and they can talk about kind of Manchester United, and they can talk about Arsenal, not to massive great depths, but the average American is aware of this thing now. So isn't it, you know, so I think you Americans are becoming to love the beautiful game.
It's such a thing for me. It's such a thing from difficult thing for me to wrap my head around in my own personal experience, because I lived in Texas until 2009. And yeah, to an extent you saw that. And I think that was also somewhat of a reaction to it being a more popular sport on the high school level. So more and more people just happened to know how to play it than they used to. Right. So, you know, that was certainly kind of a thing, but I would also point out Texas is also a heavily Latino state. And so soccer was being played on the TVs there because, you know, Mexican immigrants and whatnot. And in fact, I was in Dallas for the Champions League game. And I will say that I went to this bar in Dallas to watch it, and it was packed to the absolute rafters. And to my surprise, I thought it would all be Real Madrid fans, but it was, you know, half and half with Liverpool. So maybe in the past almost decade since I've moved away from Texas, it's gotten more popular everywhere in the U.S. But it's a little tough for me to say, like living in New York, where everything's a little bit more European, right?
Are you New York Red Bulls or New York City?
New York City.
Oh. Good answer. Correct answer. Well done. Mick, is this team, is this group of individuals with Harry Kane you know, as our talisman, the right bunch of guys in white shirts to help lift our mood as we go into the hot baking summer. Because, you know, just before you answer, sir, it was just to say that I felt part of a national euphoric mood when I was in the pub watching that 6-1, is putting it mildly. It was the stereotypical strangers next to you, hugging you, kissing you. You know, it was just I feel like something has absolutely switched in the country watching this English team play.
You're soft as shite, you are. You really are.
I am.
I mean,
I am. Listen, Mick. I'm not as cynical as you.
I'm getting more and more convinced I can sell you a big bridge in London. I really am. You're the kind of person that billboards work on. I have a sort of bicameral experience with this in my head, because in the one hand, I think. I think I would like England to win or to get far in the tournament, because I was a little kid the last time we really had a potential that we might, you know, the year of Gascoigne's legendary tears and us unfairly getting bumped out early when we should have made that final. So I like that in some ways. But on the other side of it, if we win the World Cup, the Brexiteers are going to be even more unbearable than they are now. So I sort of don't want this.
Don't worry, you're not going to win the World Cup.
How dare you? This is like when someone insults your kids. I can criticize my own kids, right? So, but you can't.
Yeah, and at least we're there. You've got to be in it to win it. Where is America in this tournament, Amanda?
I'm
320 million with the sixth most attended soccer league. Oh God, I said that. Oh God, oh God, no.
That's what you become. The sixth most attended
football, because it's called MLS. I had MLS on the brain. The sixth highest attended football league on planet Earth. Right, you've got David Beckham buying franchises, etc., and you couldn't come out of the group of CONCACAF, which has only Mexico is the only country of any repute when it comes to football you need to play against. The rest is St. Kitts, Cuba, Jamaica, Nicaragua. Rubbish. You should feel ashamed of yourselves. Call yourselves the leaders of the free world.
Do you know what? I'm excited about 2026 because it's the first World Cup in a long time that I'll be able to go to. Banned from Qatar, banned from Russia. At the moment, I'm not banned from the US. So
give it time, Mick. It happens to the best of us. But anyway, Amanda, all right, stick up for America. Please explain to me the reason why you guys are not at this World Cup. Please.
Oh, I mean, we suck, and that's fine. You know, I think we had some folks over to watch the games on Saturday, and I think everyone at my place agreed that in the grand scheme of things, we were glad the U.S. didn't qualify this year, because it would have felt bad to root for us when Trump is our president. And now we can just put all of our energy into rooting for Mexico and leave it at that.
But why are you rooting for Mexico when surely you should be supporting your English cousins?
Well, now I'm not speaking for all Americans, but for myself, I'm...
On this podcast, you are. Au contraire, on this podcast, you are the voice of America.
Well, and I will tell you that the voice of America, when they are a Texan, is a Texan first and an American second. I grew up on the border of Mexico. My family's from Mexico on one side. It's very hard. I'm congenitally incapable of not rooting for Mexico.
So, Mick, you're trying to tell me, right, beforehand, that I am just away with the fairies. I'm soft. I'm gullible, and this whole thing of there being a change in the mood in England around the English football team is just a media construct. And I'm just gullible, and I bought it.
How many pints did you have?
Mick, I'm fundamentally teetotal, sir.
Right, well, how many pints of people around you had?
Mick, all right, I'm going to go back.
Look, no, I'm not, as you said earlier in this podcast, I'm not sufficiently happy with the answer to that question. Yeah.
Mick.
Yeah.
Mick.
I hate it when you say my name this much.
Mr. Wright.
Yes. Oh, even worse. Carry on.
Our correspondent from Norwich. How is that better? Right.
Not especially. Carry
last
on.
World Cup. Oh, gosh, last World Cup I was in San Francisco. All right, well, one before that, 2010. There wasn't the mood around this team. In 2006, yes, there was in Germany because we believe we had the golden generation with your Lampard, your Gerrards and all of that. Okay, and we went into that World Cup thinking, we can kind of do something, and we got shown up. But I think, for me, part of this elation around this team is because for the second or the third time, we've actually gone into a tournament with zero expectations, with the exception of Harry Kane and possibly Raheem Sterling. He was pumped up by the press just before the World Cup. This is not a team of household names, is it?
You know, no, I think that's a great thing. And look, the other thing about it is I think people quite like Gareth Southgate as a manager, right? He's not foreign, which, sorry, British people do not enjoy having foreign managers in the national team. They really don't. Like, don't get my dad started on that. Whether that's an issue or not. It's a fact. It's a fact. I think people think that there should be an English manager for the England team. The other thing
I'm inclined to agree. If you need a nationality qualification to play,
same.
I think the manager should be the same. Yeah,
and the manager certainly should be able to speak English, which was the problem we had with Capello. His spoken English was not that good. But anyway, the other thing is, I think people look at Southgate and they kind of see him as a sort of talisman in the sense that he's one of the like talismanic misses of a penalty, you know. But also, he just seems like a nice bloke. Where the big worry he had before the Panama game was that he was wearing a light blue shirt and that wasn't going to hide any of the sweat. Just like, this is brilliant. It's like having Alan Partridge manage the England team, but I sort of love it. So I think there's that. And also, you're right, not a load of household names, but they play as a team and they kind of don't seem like dickheads, which is, you know,
it's a huge thing.
Yeah, it's the polar opposite of when I watch the Super Bowl, when I have to sort of do a tally of which team has fewer domestic abusers and convicted rapists on it, and then go, okay, which team do I hate least on that basis? So I kind of think, you know, this is a good thing.
You know, that is a fair yardstick to measure when you're watching any, as a neutral, watching any kind of American NFL game. But
it's incredible to see the number of players that can still play. Like, you wouldn't be able to be in the Premier League with some of these guys' conviction records. It's insane.
No, that is true. But you can't ever be rooting for the New England Patriots, though, can you?
Amanda? No.
You've been a good Texan.
No.
All right, you back me up on that.
Yeah, I mean, I must.
And don't tell me you're a Cowboys fan, because otherwise your position on this podcast will be terminated.
No, I hate the Cowboys. Good. Oh my God. Yeah, I mean, I think you hate the Cowboys. If you hate the Cowboys and you're from Texas, you hate them even more.
Good. Now, Amanda, right, because your country is still finding its soccer ball kind of bona fides and stuff, you are actually going to round off this section by telling us who is going to win the World Cup and why.
Oh God, I'm not.
And then, which country deserves to win the World Cup?
Oh, God, I really don't know. I really don't know. I'm not that good at this stuff. You've got me, man. I think that, I would have, if I was a betting person, put money on Germany, I suspect, early. But I don't know now. On the other hand, you know, they did kind of pull it out in that game with Sweden, so I wouldn't count them out. I really don't know. What I've watched does not give me any sense of it. You would probably have a much better guess.
Well, the attacking verb and quality that England has shown in its two games has not tilted you to believe, well, you know what, it's England's time.
No, I think you're going to have to do more than beat Panama.
We beat the mighty Tunisians too.
I think Germany can still win it because they've come out of group stages in the past and done a lot better than they did in the group stage. And I would love to see an African team win. So I'm still backing the great kit wearing Nigeria. Of course, they won't win.
You know, I don't get this. Before we move on to takeaways of the week, right? I don't get the furore around the Nigerian kit. I think it's ugly. It's an acid late 1980s, early 1990s English first division football top. It's like it's the green and white version of the Arsenal away kit when they won the championship under George Graham. It's horrendous. I don't like it. But anyway, on that note, move on to our takeaways of the last 7 days. Hello and welcome to The Things That Made England. I'm Roy Phil Brown, and with me I have
David Crowther of The History of England.
It was the best of times, it was the worst of times.
She was the people's princess.
Crystal fight on the beaches.
Oh, hey, man, these are the things that made England.
Crystal fight on the landing ground.
These are the things that made England.
I have the body but of a weak and feeble woman.
These are the things that made England.
And a king of England, too.
These are the things that made England.
Cry God for Harry!
And these are the things that made England.
England! And St. George!
These are the things that made England.
It gives wind in Churchill's sails to say we can continue to fight on.
Well, there cannot be many more famous events in English history than 1066. It hurts, even now.
Because 1066 is important.
Yeah.
But there's aspects of modern British culture which I think get overlooked. So I'm proposing that this week we do Scar.
For me, the English flag has in the past certainly become associated with factionalism and, well, hideous racist and far-right views. And it's turned into a thing of disunity and almost xenophobia.
The idea of this show is to decide on what things that make England
as she is, the country that, despite it all, we feel lucky to be part of.
Every week, one of us, that's David and I, will pitch an idea to the other to be designated as one of the things that makes England distinctive.
Go and join our shiny new Facebook site where once a month we will post a poll where, should you so desire, you can make your own very suggestions for applications to the I Made England Award. So, without more ado, let's do it.
It's that time where we chill and relax with friends and we just talk about anything which isn't to do with politics, though the World Cup kind of comes with that category too. But anyway, Mick, as always, you've called me rude. You've been somewhat confrontational in this podcast, though. But to be fair to you, right, you dialed it down a notch or two. All right. So we're going to start with you. What's been your takeaway the last 7 days?
Hang on. Can we address that first, you bollock? Right. Now, look, listeners need to realise that you and I are very good friends because people don't realise this. So I just want to put that out there. But moving on from that, it always hurts my feelings. So here's the thing, right? What interests me is, Royford, have you heard of Logan Paul?
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. Have you heard of KSI?
No.
Nah, well, there you go. So, KSI is a British YouTuber who has 18 million subscribers. And he previously had a white-collar boxing match against another British YouTuber. And at the end of that fight, he challenged the Paul brothers to a boxing match. So, that's happening on August the 25th. And I think it's really interesting because there's this whole world of YouTube stuff, right? And sometimes, like an iceberg, the tip of it breaches through into popular culture, like the rest of culture, right? And everyone hears about it. So most people heard about Logan Paul and Suicide Forest and, you know, questions of, like, was that appropriate? Because it was sort of a moral question. And is he an idiot? Yes, he is. But this is amazing, right? They are at Manchester Arena having a boxing match, a transatlantic contest between these two guys who, between them, have got something like 100 million fans. That's insane. That is insane. Also, when we're talking about national pride, I'm hoping that KSI knocks Logan Paul out, but that's by the by. But anyway, it's interesting. This is a huge thing, and it's selling out a big stadium, and yet, you know, it's what, like, it doesn't make it, you know, it would make It's not like, remember when Oasis and Blur trying to get a number one record at the top of things? It's the equivalent of that, and most people don't know it's happening. Well, old people don't know it's happening. Me being one of them. My apprentice actually
told me.
Well,
you do know it's happening. Oh, wow. Okay. All right. Well, now, there is this phenomenon of, well, it's a symptom, isn't it, of the fragmentation of media. And you're completely right to use that Blur and Oasis analogy. So for our American listeners, in the mid-90s, Blur and Oasis were the two biggest bands in the UK, and there was a massive rivalry. There were the indie kind of Britpop bands, and there was a massive rivalry, and they would deliberately put out records to see which one could get to number one. But it was a media moment. And media moments are becoming less and less. It's not that there aren't any. So when Beyonce decides to do an album with her hubby, we read about it and stuff. But you're completely right to point this up as something which is peculiar, that you can have people who are have such renown in one specific field, YouTube, but it's not in the popular consciousness, i.e. the mainstream media, and I don't want to sound like a Fox News kind of host, but the mainstream media, it matters not a jot to, and they're not talking about it. Because I've never heard of KSI, and I've only heard of Logan Paul because of the controversy that he's involved in before. I didn't know of his work beforehand. But,
Yeah, work is overselling it, really, but yeah.
His output then, sir. His output. Amanda Marcotte. When he hips to Brooklyn, over to you, madam.
So, this week I finally caught up on, and there's still some more episodes to be released on Hulu, The Handmaid's Tale, and I have to say it's been absolutely a fascinating show. I'm a big fan of the original novel by Margaret Atwood. I actually wrote my senior thesis about it. The first season of the show, while it added a lot of stuff, basically followed the bare bones of the plot of the original novel. So it's been interesting watching a second season of the show where they really kind of move on past the original novel. And I think that obviously there are other shows that have done this, like Game of Thrones and whatnot. But this is the first time I've ever seen a TV show that takes what I would consider like a literary novel, like a classic literary novel, and does that with it. It sort of expands on it as a TV show instead of just faithfully adapting it. It's a hell of a been a hell of an experiment, and I've been surprised and pleasantly so at how good they've done.
And how far into the second season are we at the moment? Or are you at the moment?
I've finished what's aired. I watched, I don't want to spoil anybody, but there's a few more episodes that are coming this season. And it's been very interesting because they filmed a lot of this stuff before the current political moment, but the season has been almost uncomfortably close to a lot of things that are happening in the real world, particularly in focusing heavily on the damage that happens when parents are forcibly separated from children.
That's so interesting, isn't it, given that Atwood like set herself that rule that in the original book everything had to have happened somewhere in the world.
Yeah. And I suppose like that actually sort of made whatever decisions they make in the show likelier to sort of dovetail with what's happening in the real world. Because I will say Atwood's point in doing that was to make the point that tyranny always sort of follows the same forms no matter what time or, you know, historical period you're in.
Good call. Good call. I must admit, I absolutely enjoyed season one and haven't got around to watching season two, so you've reminded me that that's another bit of quality TV that I need to jump into. And my, I must admit, I came into this takeaways of the week absolutely not having one, and my takeaway, I suppose, is this, and I've had to scramble for one whilst you and Nick were speaking, Amanda, is that coming back home to Birmingham, the Midlands, you realize the kind of the subtle differences in kind of culture, and just in one of them, and whether that is me spending the last 20 odd years of my life in London and then on and off for the last 4 years in the Bay Area in San Francisco, is that people here watch TV. And in a passive way, which I haven't seen for years, i.e. people here still switch on the TV and things just happen in front of them. I've watched so many episodes of Catchphrase going around to friends, which I wouldn't watch in a million years. And Catchphrase is this somewhat down at heel game show where you have to guess the catchphrase by some cartoon characters which are on the screen. And then the news just comes on, and then EastEnders comes on, and then some another show comes on. And I haven't watched TV like that in at least 10 years. That if you talk about The Handmaid's Tale, that's a HBO show, isn't it?
It's Hulu.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But
streaming.
Actually, even that, the fact that I didn't know the channel is kind of almost making my point. That what I was going on to say is that I and many people like me, and I'm guessing that you two are similar, we watch shows and we have little and no allegiance to the channel that originated it. So if anything, you go, I'm watching something on Netflix. But I'm not watching an ABC, a CBS, a BBC necessarily, or an ITV show. I'm watching this program, which I've been told is of sufficient quality. I don't watch the output of a station. And it's just, you know, I come around to my mum and dad's, I kind of expect them to switch on the TV and there to be, oh, you know, some kind of game show on that late on in the afternoon. But I put that down to them being seniors now. And that is just the way that they consume their media. But actually, people my age and younger here still watch and consume TV in that traditional way. And you look at all the stats from the BBC and they just say that iPlayer, when England played, I think it was Panama, that it was the most amount of streams they've ever had from BBC iPlayer. And it was 85% of the TV watching public was watching that game. That's event TV. There's a quintessential notion of event TV. I watch that on TV. I wouldn't watch Catchphrase or some game show or Jeremy Kyle or anything else. But what I would do is choose, in effect, some kind of box set which delivered through something which kind of looks like a TV. So that's just it. I hadn't really thought of one. But it's,
I'll tell you something though. Never watch the football on streaming, because my neighbours will like, we don't have a TV aerial, right? Exactly, so we're watching on streaming, and our neighbours were ahead of us. So I knew whenever England scored a goal because I heard them scream, and then I saw the goal, which is a weird and not optimum experience for football watching.
I watched the Golden State Warriors, I believe, in Game 7. So, no, not Game 7, Game 4, because we beat the Cavaliers for Zip. And I was streaming it. I had a friend in the US who was watching it on TV, and I kept open FaceTime on my laptop or something on my iPad. And actually, I was 10 seconds ahead of her. And I was streaming it and she was watching TV. So I was going, way, and whatever. So yeah, it was exactly that experience, but in reverse. But anyway, folks, let's move on from talk of streaming TV box sets and weird and wonderful YouTube celebrities who are going to kick hell out of each other, punch hell out of each other in front of millions of people on that streaming platform. This has been another Mid-Atlantic with our Texan from El Paso, Amanda Marcott, and Mick Wright, our somewhat Irish person that lives in Norwich. Amanda, what are you up to at the moment just before you go?
I'm still writing for salon.com, and you can find me on Twitter at Amanda Marcott.
And you, Mr. Wright?
I write for GQ and the New Statesman when they bother to commission me, which is occasionally, and run my own company, the Means Agency. So on Twitter, I'm at Broken Bottle Boy, and the Means Agency is at Read the Means. Commission us to do cool stuff because I need money.
And I must admit, I've got a nice little commission at the moment. I'm actually doing a set of podcasts for the Commonwealth at the moment. So thank you, Commonwealth, for trusting me with such a weighty job. You can find me on the socials where I am at Royfield. And because the name Royfield is made up, I'm just Royfield anywhere. We are at Mid-Atlantic Show on the Twitters. Remember, folks, we are the good guys. We are the voice of, I would say, the pleasant, but also sometimes the angry, the bellicose left also. But fundamentally, we are the good guys. See you all again soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.